Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
We have a return visit from one of the finest artists, that, I guess, in the music world today, Paul Jacobs, organist. Welcome, Paul, once again to Crossover.
Oh, Jill, it's a pleasure to be back.
And you are continuing to do new things, and I think our audience would be delighted to hear what your plans are and what you are doing here in Philadelphia. We will be airing this show after your performance, but even so, you've done up till now some premieres, isn't that right?
Yes. In September of 08, I had the privilege of re-premiering a work of Samuel Barber that he composed in 1927 at the age of 17.
Oh, it's a very early work.
It's an early work. He was still a student of at Curtis. And this work apparently has not been performed since 1928. It received one performance by an organist named Carl Weinrich and hasn't been performed since that time. And I met at a concert in New York the renowned Barber scholar Barbara Heyman, and she asked if I would be interested in re-premiering this piece. And being an admirer and lover of Barber's music, I jumped at the opportunity. I said, absolutely.
How do you feel about it?
Well, I think it is quite an extraordinary little jewel. We know that Barber was a perfectionist as a composer. He was not the most prolific composer to have lived, but what he did leave us is quite fine, and there's no question that this music will last. He was a bit reluctant to release several of his earlier works. This is one of them. But like that early cello sonata, which I think has made it into the repertoire, I'd like to see this organ piece do the same, because there's much to admire in it.
Now, is this the only thing he's ever written for organ?
No, there are a few other works for organ. Barber himself did play the organ, so he understood the instrument and I think composed very well for it. I wish he wrote more.
Yes. Is it challenging technically or?
Not really. The nature of this piece is contemplative. The prelude is unmistakably Barber. You have all of these
lyrical and
lyrical, lush. The influence of Brahms is there, wonderfully chromatic, understated melancholy, really gorgeous, skillful writing, but skillful writing with an emotional end. All of this compositional technique served an emotional end.
So, and it's very short, isn't it?
Yes, just about 7 minutes. The prelude about 3 and the fugue about 4.
Now, this was a premiere, is that right?
Yes, that's right. I played this work to dedicate the new organ at 10th Presbyterian in Center City. And incidentally, former Surgeon General C. Everett Koop was a member of the church and was there for the performance.
What a special event.
Oh, it was. It was very meaningful to me, and I hope for the congregation in the city of Philadelphia.
Oh, I'm sure that they loved it. Well, you know, I always find it fascinating that organists have to go to the instrument. I mean, it's really, you can't just move it.
No, we have to spend quite a bit of time becoming familiar with these instruments. The organ, no two organs are exactly alike, even by the same builder.
Well, the challenge is also, I think, the touch. I mean, I would imagine that there is, everyone is different. It's like playing a different piano, in a sense, for the keyboard. And certainly the footwork is rather tricky, too, isn't it?
Yes, and perhaps even more different than going from piano to piano is going from organ to organ, because organist, we have to think about so many non-musical things when we're playing. It's not just the notes, not just the music.
Well, people don't realize that you just don't sit down at an instrument and then kind of extemporize and go into this trance. It's very mechanical in many, many cases. And of course, the organ is overwhelming, I think.
It is. The organ is the most machine-like of instruments, and that can be a blessing and a curse. A curse in the sense that it is extremely difficult, or it can be difficult with some instruments, to make music on them, because an organist is detached from the sound, far more so than when one's playing any other instrument.
Now, you are head of the department at Juilliard, the organ department at Juilliard. When you teach your students, do you have them play on different instruments?
Yes, that is very important. And we have various styles of instruments at Juilliard. I think that it's important because in the real world, they're going to confront many organs, and it's our job to make every instrument sound as good as possible. Even if the organ isn't particularly impressive, to make it sound better than it is. Some organs you don't have to work very hard at all. They're absolutely stunning. And you have some really fine organs in Philadelphia.
Have you ever played the Wanamaker organ?
Yes, I have.
What kind of an experience is that?
Oh, my. Well, that is an experience unlike any other.
It's like flying the Concorde or something.
Well, and I don't think it's any coincidence that there are several organists who have been and are airplane pilots.
Really? But when you sit down at some of the consoles and you have all the stops and, I mean, hands and feet and so much to concentrate on, but it does look like a cockpit.
Well, we'll have to ask Peter Conte if he...
Well, he's said it many times, but he, of course, is enthralled with all of the changes. Now, so you are head of the department and you teach, you also concertize, and do you have any other position within, like in New York City, say perhaps with a church?
I am artist in residence at Christ in St. Stephen's Episcopal Church, which is pretty close to Juilliard, actually a 5-minute walk. And I'm very fond of my life in New York. It has taken me some time to get to know that city because I do so much traveling and performing, and I'm outside of the city.
As I think one of the great writers said, New York is a state of mind.
Yes. Well put.
Now the thing is this, you are young, and how old were you when they appointed you chair of that department?
Let's see, I guess I was, I started teaching at 26 and the following year, so 27.
So that's very, very young. Where did you study, and give our audience a little background just to refresh their memories?
Absolutely. Well, I am a Pennsylvanian. I'm from Washington, which is near Pittsburgh. Then at 18, I moved to this beautiful city of Philadelphia to study at Curtis, where I double majored in organ and harpsichord with John Weaver and Lionel Party, respectively. From there, I went to Yale, to the School of Music, and I was there for 3 years studying with Thomas Murray. And following that, I began teaching at Juilliard.
Voila, as we say. But so we have our various camps here of the conservatories here. So we have Curtis here in Juilliard in New York and the New England Conservatory and so on and so forth. I guess that still exists.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, there's a kind of a friendly challenge that exists, I guess. Still.
Yeah, what's wrong with competition?
That's right. And especially in the music business. Now, I am very, very impressed with organists, I have to tell you, not only because of their musical expertise, but intellectually I've found, certainly working with Peter on the Wanamaker Organ Hour, we've interviewed a lot of organists, and the organists go far beyond just the musical, the repertoire, and of course the technical thing. There's a lot of thought that goes, a philosophy.
Yes.
Which you are very, very committed to.
Yes, I am. I suppose, I think it's important for musicians to think. You know, feeling is crucial, and I think that's perhaps even more important, arguably. But there needs to be thought. The brain, the intellect is part of our being as well. And I, look, musicians need to be able to do more than just play their instrument well these days. They have many more hats to wear. We have to evangelize for music. And we have to do that through not only playing, but speaking and writing and communicating with other souls on other levels.
How do you do that as a musician other than performance?
Well, we're doing it right now through interviews, through radio, through writing. I speak at my recitals and my concerts. I think it's very important not to become indifferent. For instance, I had a revelation just a little bit ago this fall. I was taking a walk through an autumn woods, and the golden light was filtering through the leaves of the trees, and I was so profoundly moved by the nature of this light, this warmth, this mature golden ambience, and it made even a clear blue sky seem bland and uninteresting. But what I was thinking is, how many times had I experienced that same situation, but I was indifferent to it, I was apathetic? And it made me wonder, how many times in life do I go through when I should be more sensitive to beauty? I think they're probably a lot more than I could count.
Well, I think we also live in a time where there's a barrage of sound and visual experience that begins to turn you off to, you know, you become inured in a way. But I will say about autumn, that's my favorite season, and I've always felt that there's something very profound about autumn. About autumn, because there's an incredible intensity of color and beauty, but it's the storm before the calm, in a sense, because it is before winter, and one always associates it with, and it has been said that that's the autumn years and then old age and so on and so forth. But I think you're absolutely right about the beauty of the season. But as far as being sensitive to it, that is a chore now.
That is a chore. We have become desensitized, I suppose, all of us in culture, because we're saturated, as you said, with so much information, good and bad, and we have to weed out. We have to get rid of these things.
You had said to me in just our little chat before the show that you wanted to build a bridge from the organ into the world, the rest of classical music, the world of classical music. Well, doesn't the organ repertoire have a great deal of classical music? Aren't you involved?
Very much so, and a lot of people realize this, but I think that there's room to improve, and it is my dream to build even a modest bridge from the organ world into the broader world of music, ultimately, because we have only good things to reap from experiencing these great pieces of organ literature, pieces which some of which are centuries old, but still relevant. They still have things to say. And, you know, for instance, how wonderful it is that Philadelphia, the Kimmel Center, has this great organ, and now they can program literature that hasn't been heard in a long time, such as the Copland Organ Symphony that I'll be playing with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Yes, and that's something, of course, that is it's not terribly done terribly often.
No, it isn't. And it should be heard more frequently. It's a superb piece of music.
Well, I was also discussing with organists about some of the orchestral literature that uses organ, not as a solo instrument, but it's part of it. And we're not terribly aware of some of the piece. I know Richard Strauss uses organ, and also the, Schwanda the bagpiper, Weinberger, uses the organ, I think, for a few measures, but
oh,
it's
yes,
terribly, terribly important. And the Saint-Saëns is really not an organ symphony. It's a symphony with an organ playing.
Yes.
So I myself felt that the organ is used in that sense as an orchestral instrument, not as a solo instrument
that's
that represents the orchestra.
I think in that case, you know, and as far as the Saint-Saëns, it's a bit surprising almost that the organ is more of a presence.
That's really what it is.
It really is, because Saint-Saëns was quite a virtuoso organist, knowing his solo work, but he chose not to pursue that end for the organ in this symphony.
I wonder if composers that played the organ felt that it was part of their, oh, I guess it was their education, because you can learn how to voice things and you can use certain stops to represent the orchestra. I mean, this was the king of instruments. Isn't that what it was called in the old days?
That's right.
But, so when you talk about connecting the organ literature to the rest of classical music, I guess what you're really talking about is taking it out of the liturgical.
Yes. I suppose, in a sense, I don't think it should be taken lightly that the organ has served and continues to serve liturgy and church music quite profoundly. I mean, look at Messiaen. Here's a 20th century composer, and this man wasn't merely spiritual. This man was religious. There was a great clarity to his thinking and his religious convictions. And he said that the organ above all should be exciting, even in religious settings. And I do.
But it really is.
Of course it is.
It can't help but be. I mean, some of the things you just are enthralled.
Well, they're the stereotypes that the organ is a funeral instrument. And unfortunately, people have experienced it only in that light and haven't heard the other sides to it.
Well, it's a bridal instrument.
And weddings too, yes.
That's right. So as far as literature is concerned, then when you teach at school, say, what do you introduce to the students, really, in terms of repertoire?
Well, in addition to a passion for playing, because I think that organists on the whole could let their hair down more, some of them. As you pointed out, organists have the reputation of being thoughtful, very intelligent. Frequently, they're teaching harmony and counterpoint.
Yes, and their transcriptions. I mean, it's part of being an organist.
That's right. But also, again, we talked about communication and passion and this sense of duty to spread the word, to not keep something which is so beautiful, something that you know can affect and change people's lives for the better to themselves.
So again, how does one do that? Talk?
Oh, I talk. They hear it every week in organ class at Juilliard. And I should also point out that if any of your listeners happen to be in New York City on Thursdays at 11 o'clock in the morning, they are more than welcome to visit organ class at Juilliard. You just show up and tell security you're there for organ class.
Oh, that's wonderful. How many students do you have there now?
10.
That's pretty much the pool, right?
Yes, I wouldn't want it to be much larger than that. It seems to be a comfortable fit.
Now, you are again touring. When do you do that? Do you do that during the academic year? Or?
Yes, well, I am considered full-time at Juilliard, and I will teach Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, sometimes on Friday. But I will often have a Friday and or a Sunday concert in another city or other cities. Monday is usually a travel day for me back into the city.
So do you have any repertoire that you're looking forward to introducing to the public?
Oh, my, yes. Goodness, we could do another show just on that, I suppose. And revisiting, certainly, the music of Bach. Every time I sit down to play this composer or spend time with him, I hear new things, I play things differently.
You know, I remember you saying that when I spoke to you. Couple of years ago, I think, you said you always go back to Bach and it refreshes you.
Oh, it does. That composer who gives strength and refreshes the spirit. I think that was a quote of Schumann or Mendelssohn.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you certainly are refreshing to speak with Paul Jacobs, and I'm so glad that you found the time to come here. As I say to our audience, we're speaking to Paul prior to 4 performances, is it, here of the Copland Organ Symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra. We will be airing the show after that, but thank you so much for taking time out to speak with us.
Oh, Jill, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure as always.